Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. The Dow set a new all-time high, but can that momentum continue? Ross examines crude, gold, and the U.S. and Canadian dollars. One of Canada's top all-time realtors, West Vancouver's Alan Mark Angel, joins us to discuss high-end real estate. He discusses why having a great realtor can make all the difference if you're trying to move your house in a slow market. Author of several books on the economy, including The Money Bubble, John Robino, joins us from Washington State to talk about China's slowing economy, U.S. states opposing the American federal government's slack policy on immigration, and possible future energy solutions. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on X at Charts by Ross. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Always a pleasure, Jim.
How did the stock markets end the week?
Well, it was a pretty darn week, darn good week for most of them. You know, the Dow's at a new high close at the end of the week. S&P and NASDAQ, the weekly close is up into all-time highs, although there was a bit of a setback on Friday. But, my gosh, it's nothing in comparison to what we've been seeing on the upside. We are starting to, you know, see some excesses again. There was that correction right into the first week and a half of January, and then that got a little bit oversold, just enough to set this thing in motion. We're up now to the point where the indicators are getting a little pricey, so a choppy period up here. We want to see how the next correction holds. Ideally, you take a look at the S&P, which is just shy of just shy of 4,900 right now. The most recent breakout was at 4,800, and I wouldn't want to see it overlap that 4,800 by much. Otherwise, we would be into a more of a rolling top rather than this rising trend that we're in right now. Want to keep an eye on the Dow versus industrials versus the Dow transports. Now, the transports topped in July and is along with the Dow industrials, and so everything had that good break into the following months. But the movement in the transports coming back now has been very lethargic. And it is well below the levels that we saw in July. That's the early stage of what you would look for as a Dow 30 sell signal when you've got the one of the scene not doing well relative to the other one. And then if you were to roll over and take out the support, that would give you just the major signal in itself. Now, to confirm what's going on in here, with this weakness in transports, you take a look at the utilities, which also topped back in the summer, had a pretty good rally into the first part of this year, but that index has dropped from 900 down to about 840, and it's actually taken out its first level of support. So the internals are not as good as they had been a few months ago. We also take a look at things like the advanced decline line, which is failing in the last 4 weeks to participate in the move on the upside for the broad indices. You know, and we know things you know, the Magnificent Seven here in terms of the stocks of with their capitalization just dominating the not only the S&P and the NASDAQ, but into the Dow as well. So it's at this point, you know, one of those markets where you've got to be in either that, you know, top 20 or 30 stocks, or you're not seeing much price action as far as the individual stocks are concerned.
What's going on with crude?
Crude oil, just beautiful here. So we got the December low, which is the first part of the seasonal action for a bottom. We got the retest then again in January. And that's what you want to see as the oil market bottoms out. And at this point, this week was just a nice breakout. We had been looking at, you know, there was a $74 to $76 overhead resistance. The 50-day moving average was in there at $75. And early part of the week, you know, we put out an additional piece, you know, saying that this base looked to be complete. We were ready for a move. So Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, you know, here we are going from under 75 to closing up at 78. Nice breakout, and that's the crude oil market. The gasoline is into its seasonal play as well, and doing nicely, coming off the bottom. So for futures or ETF traders or people who want to have the call options, these are a pretty good piece of the market to be looking at. You know, and in particular, the you know, this is a move that is usually lasts well into February in virtually all years, and in a good percentage of them will carry out right into March, April. So, any dips that you see, you know, in the next few weeks on the daily basis, you might want to take a look at picking up some additional positions there. As I say, the basing action provided nice ability to pick up positions. But, you know, once the trend starts in motion, you might as well play with it.
What's going on with gold?
Gold has just not had any decent price action here, you know, in the better part of, you know, a month or so. We had the after the big spike up and testing the high back in December, and the retest in January at just around 2100, this breakdown and holding around the 2010 level on the spot price, it just doesn't seem to have you know, any legs in it. The bounces are very small. The commitment of traders numbers, take a look at the figures that came out at the end of this week. Both the speculative long and short positions have dropped significantly, so participation in the market is dropping off. You know, and we've got this just lethargic kind of action. So unless this we can push through the, call it the 2040 level on some rising volume, I think that you know, it's got the chance for a spike to the downside still, and you know, a good oversold reading would be an opportunity to be looking at the longs. You know, we've been bullish on this one for the seasonal play coming out of November, December, and that pretty much is running out of time at this point. So I will look for just some independent price action to say that there's anything really worth doing any new positioning in that market.
What's happening with the U.S. and Canadian dollars?
Stuck in trading ranges for both of them. The dollar index, the U.S. one, got up against the 50-week moving average 2 weeks ago at the 103.5 to 104 level, and coming off that oversold reading in December, this was sort of the optimum level to look for the rally. If it can manage to close through here, you know, then we're talking about a new game altogether rather than this bounce in a downtrend. So I think that you keep a good eye on that probably 104 level on the dollar index. If it pushes through there, it's going to have some legs. Personally, you know, I look at it and say there's, you know, you've had two good waves of buying off the bottom, and maybe there's that one more left. But if it can't push through 104, you're probably looking at a further move back on the downside. On the Canadian, sort of with U.S. dollar, not any big price action. You know, here we are at 74 and a quarter at the end of the week. We've been plus or minus, you know, 30 or 40 points on this for the last 10 or 15 days. And if the dollar, if the U.S. dollar tops out, then I think, you know, the Canadians got a chance to push back towards, you know, 75 again. But we're in a trading range. I don't see anything overbought or oversold enough to give us any guidance. So just to just sit back and wait for another opportunity.
Ross, thank you so much for the update.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure to be back with you, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark for chartsandmarkets.com. Find him on X at Charts by Ross. Coming up, Alan Mark Angel next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
My guest is Alan Mark Angel, one of the top realtors in Canada. He has sold more than 4,000 properties. He's located in West Vancouver, British Columbia, and online at theangelgroup.com. That's A-N-G-E-L-L group.com. Alan, welcome back to This Week in Money.
Thank you kindly.
How's the Angel Hassman expansion going?
Well, it's I tell you, it was a tough decision to do that, but when I look at what's going on, I look at my stats, I look at how many houses we used to sell. We sold 370 houses last year. The average is 711, the best is 1,200. And so it's the same in every area. So we're just not selling enough. We got 370 sales and 200 some apartments, so say 600, and we got 720 realtors in our area. So we decided it was time to go. We lost three. We lost our number one and two and eighth realtor in January. They all worked in White Rock, but they moved out there. There was a new office being built, so they left there. So we decided to expand the company, and I'm absolutely shocked at how good it is. The best thing was those three realtors came back to my office. They hated the company. They came back in November. My company now, it's absolutely amazed. Whistler office, we just opened Whistler right now. I bet we'll have Angel Hassman up the second top office. And there's a company with, I've got 18 guys. There's a company with 50 guys. We're going to take a few years to beat, but I think we'll have the second top office. I'm absolutely overwhelmed with how the people that, by top six last year, four were new. Then the three that left have come back, so that they're going to be the top ten. And I got four of the top guys at Whistler. So thank goodness we have that, because the market is scary, absolutely scary. Because like in our area, West Van, yesterday, I checked yesterday the sales for, what, the 24th? There were three sales in West Van. One was ours. Now, that's firm deals. Now, maybe there's 20 deals that are subject, they're not firm yet. So, but that's why I was waiting the 21st of the month to see. But that's the lowest I've ever seen. And so it's just insane. So I asked my girls, I said, we've only got one sale firm so far this year in my office here. I said, how many in the other offices? We got over 40 sales in all the new offices. So that was great. I mean, the new office, the first one started in March. The new office for us last year sold 60% of the Angel Hassman sales. And our company, everybody wants to be the realtors want to be with us because the high-end name's so strong. Nobody's even close to us in the high-end market. So Moody was our top realtor in the office. You know, my partner and I don't count, but Bart Moody was the top guy in the office. I mean, it's absolutely, I'm so excited I can't stand it. I just got my second knee done in December, and I thought, I'm so eager to work because the market's going to be very, very tough this year again. They say they're going to drop the interest rates, but they'll have to drop them 3 to 4% to get a change in the market. So it's the expansion was the best thing we ever did. Absolutely amazing. So I've got Kelowna, you know, I've got Abbotsford, Port Moody, Langley, White Rock, you know, and so it's just Angel Hasman is very exciting. We need more sales in West Vancouver.
As you expand, Angel Hasman, is the key to find great realtors to join your team, and what makes a great realtor?
Well, I have a little bit of a different philosophy in that. I've lived that with my whole life. I mean, I held the Canadian record in the mile when I was a kid. I've always wanted to succeed. I was only good at two or three things, but then I was useless at the rest. But I totally believe this is LSB by philosophy. In every profession, lawyer, doctor, accountant, realtor, athlete, there's probably three great ones at any time and about four good ones. Then there's all the rest. The government's made up of all the rest. That's why they never seem to do anything right. So you're never going to get a great realtor, like say the top three, but if you're lucky, you'll get, you know, one or two of the good ones. But we're very tough now. If you haven't done at least 10 deals the last year, we don't have the space, and that our girls are overworked. And so we're very tough on who we hire. And it's nice to be in that position because we turn down realtors every week now who want to come to work at the company. So we're very strict. If you're not doing the business, they're coming to us. They want the name, and that's why we're so. It's interesting because getting a good realtor with the market like this, it always amazes. I got both my NDAs done. I just got my last one done. I looked up the doctors. You know, I got to be the doctor. Did my knees. Sensational, absolutely sensational. I just can't get over how good a job he did. And I say, but it should be like this in every business. And you get sued, you want the best lawyer you can. I don't understand how these people with their houses, they list with new realtors or the friend's son just started. This year's your biggest investment. We're in the toughest market we've ever seen. The last 4 years in our era, four of them are in the worst. In the top worst six of all time. So this market is so tough. If you don't go to the best realtor, because even in a bad market, a good realtor, a great realtor can get you more money. We sold one in August over here for $32.8 million. And so it's you could still do those things, but your choice of realtor is so important. So, I mean, think of it. If you've got 720 realtors in West Vancouver, and you've got 370 sales and 200 some apartments. So, say you've got 600. That's not even one sale a realtor. So, and the top guys, the old days, I used to do 125 a year. But our business has changed now. The cultures we have, three cultures here. We have the RA, the Chinese, and all the rest. But it has changed. So you need to pick your realtor, and you need to pick a realtor you can believe in, because this is key to what is going on. Even though the market is terrible, it's like first time I became number one in 1980, I became the top realtor in Canada. By March of 1981, I was third in my office of 22 in West Vancouver. And I said, well, how could I possibly be number one in Canada? I'm third in my office of 22. The market was crashing. The interest rates were going well, but so I changed my strategy how I have to sell. I was number one in Canada again by the end of the year. So you have to choose your realtors to think about. Get the best lawyer, get the best doctor. You got to get the best realtor. And I love this now because all the offices I'm now doing today. I spent 2.5 hours on the Langley area. I want to check out all the sales since 2000, and you know. I'm getting all the sales. I want to see the patterns in there. I do every year. I'm doing Whistler now, all the areas, Port Moody, you name it, I'm doing it because I need to know what's going on. And it shocks me. The realtors don't do, I mean, I spend 20, 25 hours on stats at least a week, but I'm the only one in the business who does that. When I hired one on the office I opened last year, you know, I'm an old guy now. I mean, you know, everybody knows who I am. But, you know, I said, well, guys, I'm going to ask you, I know more about your area than anybody else does. So I said, how many sales did you have? This was March. I said, how many sales are you before? Didn't have a clue. And these are very successful realtors. Didn't have a clue. I said, well, there's 1,219. That was the second worst year you've ever had. You should know that information. That the last year went. And then I said, how many sales in January? They didn't know. I said, you had 47 sales in January. The worst you've ever had is 58. So January was the worst year, the worst month by 11 sales. The average January is 147. You're 100 sales behind that. Guys, if you're going to close a deal, you're going to list a house, you need to have that kind of information. And the realtors don't take the time to do that. I do it for all the areas, because I said so. I mean, I just, I'm excited about work. I love to do this. I must be crazy, but I love to do it.
What are your stats showing for 2023?
Well, here's the stats here. This is unbelievable. Greater Vancouver sold 7,569 houses. 7,569. The worst year since the 80s. It's 75-23. So we only beat the worst year. So we had the second worst year we've ever seen. We beat them like by 40 sub sales. Second worst. The average year for Greater Vancouver is 13,500, and we're at 7,000. The best is 22,000, and we had 769. I've got this for every area. Vancouver East, for example, very interesting, 895. That was the worst year they've ever had. The worst year before was 916. The average year is 2197, and the best year is over 4,000. So these are things that realtors should do. I mean, I've got 15 areas here, you know, Maple Ridge, White Rock, Lanny, Tri-Cities. Now I'm doing Western and Kelowna. So you need to tell people the truth. And it shocks me because even the top guys don't do this. I had a guy in my office in 2021, he said, he put out a flyer. He was the top salesman in West Vancouver that year. And he put a flyer out the year before. He said, near record number in sales. And I said, near record number in sales? I said, you were the top guy in all of West Van last year. He's worked with me for a long time. And I said, the average year is over 700. We didn't even make the average year. The best year is 1,200. You're very, very successful. So when you put something out and it says near record number of sales the year before, people are going to believe that. But that's so misleading. But they don't spend the time on the staff. And you need to be told the truth because it's easy. I've got a house I had on for 4.6, and I said it should be under 4. I went up there and talked, and they said, well, okay, so they listed under 4. Change the price. My two best friends, one's in Burnaby, one's in Richmond. They see the market over there is great. I said, well, here's the charts for Burnaby. Here's the charts for Richmond. They're both having their second worst year in history, yet your friends seem to think that the market's good. It's not. This is the second worst year. People should know the truth, but the board won't tell you that because they want people to sell houses or buy houses. So you never get the real information. But so everybody starts too high. And when you're in a falling market, you just follow it down. And it's not a fun time. But if you have this information ahead of time, the houses will sell.
This week, the Bank of Canada left the bank rate unchanged. Are the numerous bank rate increases we've had so far affecting buyers of homes?
Oh, yes. I mean, that's why it was the second worst year. Well, you think of it. Everybody got a 1.5-2% mortgage. And then they changed the rules. You couldn't port your mortgage from one house to the other. Why would anybody in the right mind sell a house with a mortgage rate of 1.5% and now have to get 7%? Nobody's going to do that. They're going to wait till their 5-year term expires and all these houses are going to come on the market. That's why I think we got 2 to 3 years before we have a reasonable market again. That's also why you should use the best realty you can, because the interest rates, I mean, how do you do that? I had one of the wealthiest families in Vancouver. If I gave you the name, you'd know who they were. I had the grandkids. They had a 1.48 mortgage on their house, and the bank says, yes, you can transfer it over. By the time when we put their home on the market and bought them a new home, they changed the rules. Their mortgage rate went to 5.08. They couldn't qualify. But lucky the parents had lots of money. They just gave them the money. But that's why I'm scared. When these mortgages become due, there's going to be a lot of people that are going to have trouble paying the new rate.
Regardless of the interest rate, is credit constriction the elephant in the room?
Oh, yeah, it's the same thing. It's just they change all the length of time I've been a realtor. The government and the banks have crashed our business like three times. The government, I blame for every bad thing that happens. It just drives me nuts. When I looked at my earnings in my office last year, it was half of what the guys normally make. The only thing I did, you know, the States is just as bad or worse. I've got a house down in L.A. We listed that for $17 million. I'm not allowed to live down there, so I work with a realtor down there. So I got one of the top ones there. And she was complaining the day, gosh, she said, I only made $500,000 last year. I haven't made less than 1.3 in years. So the markets, all North America, what the government's done, we got Trudeau and Biden, they should be responsible for all this stuff. So the bank, then when a bank gets nervous or they change, they make it harder to qualify.
Is the homes for sale inventory increasing?
Well, the product a year ago here in West Vancouver, we had 257. That was one of the lowest of all time because nobody wanted to put, you know, their low interest rate home on the market. That kept the market stable for like 6 months. The prices didn't seem to fall because there wasn't enough product. But now this year we started with 320 houses. So that's like 60-some houses more than January of last year. I mean, when the market gets bad, we get up to 450 to 500 houses. So the inventory will start to increase as these mortgages become due.
Are foreign owners selling?
Yeah, you know, the strangest thing is you take the Chinese. The Chinese, my Chinese clients, never wanted to sell. Never wanted to. They just kept their eye on China. She had 32 houses she bought here. Never wanted to sell. All of a sudden, the last couple of years, the amount of Chinese homes on the market, I'm overwhelmed. They're coming on every day.
So far, was the peak price for the luxury market back in 2016?
Well, it was. I'll just give you two areas. Vancouver West at 2016 had 34 sales over 10 million. The next one was 2021. They had 25 over. So that's the second largest year was 2021. West Van 16 and 2016, we had 14 sales over 10. But in 2021, we had one more. We had 15 sales. So it's 2016 and 2021 with the two top years. Last year in West Vancouver, we had seven.
The prime rate in 2019 was approximately 4%. Back then, Vancouver real estate was softening. The prime rate now is 7.2%. Mathematically, what should this mean for real estate?
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's going to be another. I'm very concerned about the next year or two. I think we got two to three years, you know. But as I said, what a good realtor could do is sometimes amazing. You know, we look at the houses we sell. I mean, 32 million, and I had one for 30 million. The guy made $13 million on it in 2.5 years. Then we sold an apartment for $15 million. Then we sold it 2.5 years later for $25 million. So that guy made $23 million in 4 years. So if you get the right realtor and you get the right product, you see, the high-end houses, even the Chinese, they like to put a mortgage on it for 50% to establish the credit when they move to the Canada. But if you have a great house, those buyers have lots of money. They just want the house. They don't care what they have to pay. They simply want that house, if it's an oceanfront or just a high-end special houses. So it doesn't really, Hyatt House isn't affected. Now, we say there's great deals. We had one that we thought was worth $10 billion. We put it on for $9.9. She took $7.5. Now, she didn't need the money. Her husband had passed away, and she wasn't even in the house. She just wanted to unload the house, and that was it. So that was a good deal because she lost her husband, and her life changed. But you don't find a lot of deals where the house is worth $10 and they take $6 billion, because most of those people have the money to hold on.
Could the anticipation of lower mortgage rates this year be keeping buyers on the sideline?
It could, because as I said, most people in the world were just, we're average individuals, and we hope, well, that maybe the rate will drop 3 or 4%. I don't think there's a hope in hell it's going to drop. I was talking to somebody yesterday that they still thought when the rate was going up, so people will probably sit there. But the biggest thing you got to remember is this, because we get this, I can't buy it right now, the rates are too high or something, but the fact of the matter is, if you find the house you love, you buy it today. Yes, the rates are higher, they're going to go down, but you're not going to, normally the people that I sell the houses to, they have young kids, 10 to 13 or something. They're going to live in that house for 10 to 15 years. The market's going to change twice in that period. So we get wrapped up, I better wait. So all of a sudden the rates do drop, but now you can't find the house you can't find the house that you love. I had one last year. I told these people that you're going to buy this house. And they didn't. Now I'm saying, Alan, why didn't he make us buy it? We can't find anything else that's anywhere near that. If you find a house you like, it suits your family, as long as you can make the payments, you buy it, because you're not going to be moving. Nobody's going to be buying and moving in 2 years. They're going to be 10, 50 years in the house, so no. So don't get wrapped up. You never know what the stock market's going to do. You never know. But if you're going to live long enough, you just have the time. My biggest client I had, there were two couples, 64 houses I sold over the years. And I told them, this you should buy, and I told them when to sell. You just need a realtor that will tell you the truth. And as the wife said, he just passed away. That's why I said, you made me a lot more money than my husband did being a stockbroker. So it's, the timing, that's why, as I said, I love this business to death. Nobody knows more what's going on all the areas. But when you got a realtor in Lagley, I had to go out there and show my wife's realtor. She had a client, the grandkids. I couldn't get over how hot the market was. This was probably 7 months ago. I said, there's multiple offers, but I hadn't done the stats on Lagley. So I did them, and then I realized why there was. The product, the inventory was so low. So the people were buying, they were all paying a good price, and that will drop. But the fact of the matter is, these are young buyers. They just wait while the kids are in school and they time the sale. So here's when you need, some people have to move, they get transferred or something else. But just, I always told my people, this is this is the time to sell. This is what you should buy. I'll tell you when it's better to move. I called a guy today. I says, I think it's time to sell your apartment. The other thing that's interesting about apartments, the apartment market is okay. It's an average years. All the areas, Greater Vancouver, all the areas are average. The apartment market is totally different than the housing market.
It looks like the Canadian housing market topped in early 2022 a couple of weeks ago on This Week in Money. Martin Armstrong said the waterfall moment of a real estate collapse usually happens 2 to 3 years following the market top. Your thoughts on that?
Well, that's the way it always was. You could guarantee you might have 4 years of being good, then all of a sudden 2 or 3 years when it peaks, it falls. But it changed a bit because we had the virus happen. So that changed everything. 2018 was basically, it was the worst year we ever had. Like West Vancouver, 2018 was the worst year. And then, so normally we expected the market to pick up, but the virus happened and everything else. So the last 7, 8 years have thrown us off of that. So that's why I think we got 2 or 3 years of really before the market stabilizes. But I would, if you ask me, I'm thinking of selling my own home, but because I've had my knees done and I want to get into a ranch or something like that. So even if I sell the prices as good as it was, I was buying the prices as good as it was. So I never get concerned that, but people seem to get wrapped up in that. They think they're going to time the market. The only people who time the market are people who have good luck. Nobody can guarantee you. I mean, with my stats, I was interested because I knew 2018 was the worst year, but I knew in 16 that the market had changed, because when January, February, March, April, May came in 16, the sales were twice as many as the average. By June, they got down to the average, and every month after that was lower than the average sales per year. The board even told us in August of 17, the market's great. They were a year behind. You know, that's why these charts show you exactly what's going on. But, you know, the most important thing is your family. Your family has to like the house. Your wife's got to, this has got to be her dream. So I can give people the stats, but, you know, I'll tell people, buy that house. Yes, it's right now, it's going to get six, it's going to get less for 6 or 7 months, but I would buy it because another 2 years, it'll be over that and going up. I can't get over the prices, but these houses can jump in 2 or 3 years.
Are you seeing any signs of panic selling in the high-end market?
No, not really. I mean, there's a few people anxious to sell, and especially like in the ocean fronts. We only did six on the multiple, then we did the one over 30 that was, it wasn't really on the market. But there's so few sales. You look back at the ocean fronts. I look back at the top years in waterfront sales in West Vancouver, and it's amazing. The top year was 31 sales. We had 28, 29, you know, 20, and now in the last 4 or 5 years, we had like, well, 21, we had 18, but I mean, you look at 7, 9, 18, 8, 7. So houses are so expensive, so it does get harder to, you know, there's not as many buyers who can afford $10 to $20 million houses. But most of them can hold on, and they do. So there's hardly, I mean, the one I told you about at 7.5, it wasn't nothing to do with what the market was doing. It was something that I just want to get. She didn't live in the house. I want to get it gone, and that's it. So she gave it away at that price just because she didn't need the money and wanted it sold.
Market psychology in high-end real estate. What are buyers thinking, and what are the sellers thinking?
Well, as I said, everybody assumes you're going to get great buys. Everybody expects to get great buys. If you get a great buy, it's a fluke. Yes, there may be one or two or three that look like they're great buys, but you may not like the houses. So, I get a guy who says, if you find me a great buy, you know, something that was $10 million, and now I can buy it for $7 million. But I mean, those are just about impossible buy, because even if you do, the wife has to like the house. You know, if it's a $10 million house, the wife probably, doesn't work. This has to be her pride and joy. So it's just not as affected as you expect it might be.
As inventory increases, do people who must sell their home set new valuations?
Yes, but that's when the realtor, it comes in. I look at houses out there, and I think, why haven't these realtors sat down with them, showed them the proper stats? But the board gives you stats too. But the problem is like on January the 1st, they say, here's the sales for December. I don't finalize my sales for December until like January 21st, because all these deals, the last week, 10 days of December, these deals are subject for 2 or 3 weeks. So there's no sense if it be the sales for January the 1st, say, here's December, because they're not. They're not them. So, as I said, I always use this. One year, the average year for December was 33 sales. They announced January the 1st, 31 sales. There were only 17 in December. That's a hell of a difference. The other ones came from October, November. They were handed in December. They were handed in there. But you see, I put those back. They're handed in there. I look at the deal when it comes sold. I said, oh, that was sold October the 20th. It was just handed in December. So I go back and put that back into October. So I know exactly the truth about what the market is doing. This is crucial information for buying a house.
Are people selling and then buying another home in the same area?
Yes, they are. I mean, there's a few who say, well, I might rent, but it isn't a lot of, just about everybody we sell, they buy, they're moving because they need a larger house, they need a smaller house, or they're getting divorced, or the wife or husband's business is being transferred. Those are the people that, they're always there. They don't have the luxury of waiting. And you see, even if you wait, if your house isn't that special, it doesn't matter what price range it is. If it isn't one of the best, like I show people, I got a house for 5.7 million, or I got a house for $8 million. And I show this is what's going on. This is what has sold. I got a beautiful waterfront in Port Mahoney for sale, 2 years old, and I think it's a very good buy. Both my partner and I appraised it at 8 to start with, and we put it on. Now it's in the 6s. I think it's a very good buy. In Port Moody, you got the dock. You can have your boat there. West Vancouver, you don't have docks.
How are West Vancouver waterfront properties selling?
7 sales. There's 21 for sale, and normally we get up to 24 in that range. We had 6 multiple and 1 exclusive sale last year. But that's been the normal. Other than 21, that's been the normal for the last 5 years.
How are high-end West Vancouver properties selling?
Well, as I said, they used to sell. I look at the $10 million sales. I mean, the average for the $10 million sales since the year 2000 is 8 per year. In the last few years, the average has been 5. So, it's down, but the houses are more expensive. When I look back, when I became the top realtor in 1980, by 91 sales that year, and my total volume for adding up all the 4.9 million. I was in shock. 5 million in sales. Nobody's ever done 5 million in sales. I mean, that's how much it's changed.
What's happening in the pre-sale market?
Well, we have so little of that. I mean, there's like one building here or something. We do that more in White Rock area, but I mean, they used to make, so you were guaranteed to make money in the pre-sales. You buy it now, it's built in 3 years, and you did very well. A lot of, over here, they expected to make $1 million on the place. Well, the best project in West Vancouver, they built that in 2017, and the people aren't getting their money back that they paid in 2017.
As home sales continue to slow, are realtors leaving the business?
No. This is one of the shocking things. I check the realtors every year in January. Last year we had 682. This year we had 720. Now, and so you would think, why would that be? But 720, not even one sale realtor. See, the old days when you were a realtor, you had to be a realtor, and that was it. Now you could work at the Bay and do that, or you could be a housewife and play bridge with your girlfriends, and then to what it's how you do. So that's the problem you have, because if you don't need, your husband's working and you're a housewife, but if you want to play cards with the girls or something, or golf with the girls, you could become a realtor and you'll get their house when it comes on the market. Now, you probably won't get the best price, but they feel loyal. One of my best friends is a realtor. I have to use her. But this doesn't make sense, because it may cost you $500,000 or $1 million. That's a lot.
Have you heard of people making big money in residential real estate, and how did they do it?
Well, they had a special home. As I told you, the one, the guy that I had bought it for 17, we basically sold it for 30. But that was one of the great houses. If you have a great house, the buyers that want that, it's like art. They will pay a fortune for a piece of art just because they have the money to do that. Our houses, if they're that really great, very special, one of the best 5 houses in West End, you'll get a great price for it, because the guy may be worth a few $100 million. He just wants the house. So whatever the guy paid before, he's still going to make a great profit. But those are the type of buyers you can't really cock out of them. And there's so few Yeah, two of those.
If people are planning to sell, should they be listing now?
Yes. Listen, if I'm thinking that maybe it's time to unload my own house, because I think the market, now, I pray I'm wrong, but I mean, I can't even think how many times I've been wrong or what's going on. Well, Alan says the market is, you know, it's not good. Well, but it doesn't matter. As I said, find the house your family that fits your needs and you like, and you'll live there for years. I would list right now because I think when you have three sales reported at West Vancouver, I mean, last year we had 20. The average January is 50. That's the average January over the years is 50. We have three to now. I don't know how many are stubbing deals because they're not firm yet, but let's be honest, if we're only at three right now, if we get 15 sales, that's probably where it's going to be. So I think it's going to be, until the interest rates come down 2 or 3 points, I think it's going to be tough. There's going to be a lot of these low-end mortgages expiring. There's going to be more houses on the market all the time. So it doesn't matter because, you said, it's going to change. You can wait 2 or 3 years, but what's the difference? You're going to live there 10, 12 years. Buy the one you want because I guarantee when the market hits bottom, you won't be able to find the house you like.
Mark, where's the best place for people to follow you?
Look at angelhasman.ca, Angel, A-N-G-E-L-L, Hasman, that's my partner, Hasman, H-A-S-M-A-N.ca. You see all our houses. But really, my phone number is easy, 778-888-7474, 778-888-7474. And I have charts, as I said. There's no other realtor in Vancouver who has the information that I have. I have charts for all the areas now, and I'm just finishing up Langley and Whistler today, so I can I'll tell you exactly what's going on. You call me. I mean, I get houses all over the place. I don't care. Now I have realtors all over the place, so normally what we do, if somebody wants me, you know, they live in, you know, Abbotsford or something. I had never been to Abbotsford in my life. I drove in there. We opened the Angel House, got the guys there, and drove up. Abbotsford had a mountain in Port. Well, Tri-Cities. I only sold three houses in my whole life there. But the fact of the matter is now, I know what is going on in all the areas. I'll tell you the truth. Now, what I do is drive it out to Langley or something. It could take you 2 hours or more on a Friday. So I work with one of my realtors. Every realtor I have is very, very successful. That's why the company, they're doing so well. I will work with a realtor there, so I will be involved in closing the deal. And so I can't afford 3 hours to drive out to show a house, but I'll work with the best guy I've got in the area, and because we'll make sure, and you'll get the truth about the market. Okay, Jim?
Alan, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thank you, Connie. I enjoy my work very, very much. Okay. But thank you. Take care, everybody.
My guest has been Alan Mark Angel, one of Canada's very best realtors. Find him online at theangelgroup.com, A-N-G-E-L-L group.com. Coming up, John Rubino, next on This Week in Money.
Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is John Rubino, author of several books on the economy, including The Money Bubble. He founded the website dollarcollapse.com. He's speaking to us from Washington State near Port Angeles. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Hey, Jim.
A number of U.S. states are joining Texas's rebellion against open borders. Is this the start of a civil war?
Yeah, can you believe this stuff is happening? You know, just go back 3 years,
And we were not in any active wars. We had some occupations going on, but we weren't, you know, there was no shooting. There was no, you know, major threat to global civilization or anything. And now we've got Russia-Ukraine, which has not gone away yet. We've got Israel-Gaza, which is threatening to pull the rest of the world in. And in an example of how we get pulled into these things, we're now kind of at war with Yemen over their refusal to let ships pass their coast. So you got all that going on geopolitically. And now in the U.S., I'll give you my interpretation of this, and I know there are lots of different ways of looking at it, but it seems that the party in power in the U.S. right now has decided to either just flat-out destabilize American society by opening the borders, or to change the electorate fundamentally by opening their borders, basically by letting millions of people in who tend to vote Democrat while they're brand new and dependent on the government and everything in the country. So, you know, they basically have just let millions of people flood across our border states, and Texas and a few other states are not having any more of it. So Texas is putting up barbed wire, and the U.S. government is going in and saying, no, we're going to take that wire down. And Texas is saying, no, you're not. And something like 20 other states have come in on Texas's side. So we got the very early stages of a civil war going here. It's a mess. You know, the U.S. is just a comedy of errors. I'm sorry. You know, I hate to badmouth my country like this, but geez. If we want to be respected around the world, we have to stop acting like such idiots. And hopefully we will. And we won't have World War III, and we won't have a civil war. But we're extremely close to both of those things right now.
Now, apparently China has told Iran to stop supporting the Houthis, who have been sending missiles at ships and kidnapping them, because it's bad for the world economy. And China's economy right now is already in the dumps. I don't think they want to see more harm to it. Do you think that could stop that conflict?
Well, it would help if some wiser countries got involved than the countries that are involved right now, because clearly the people who are doing it today really aren't on top of things well enough to keep it from spinning out of control. So yeah, you know, have a power like China step in and try to stabilize things. Excellent. That would be completely fine. You know, I don't know if I would call China all that stable, though. Yeah. But they're actually in the middle of a financial crisis themselves. They blew up the biggest real estate bubble in human history. They've got a demographic collapse going on where their population is decreasing at a really dramatic rate. And their stock market is tanking. So I agree with you that China doesn't want any more problems than the ones they have. And maybe that will lead them to be a stabilizing force out in the world. Who knows? We need something, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, with China's population declining, I don't see a lot of people wanting to migrate there.
Well, see, that's normally the solution. Yeah. Well, a partial solution. Yeah. You know, mass in-migration is not really a stabilizing force for most countries. But yeah, you could see China taking the population of Cameroon or something like that, moving it into their country and stopping their population decline. But that's not really their style, first of all. And there probably isn't that big of a demand, you're right, from people in other parts of the world wanting to move to China. So it's not the obvious solution that it might be otherwise. You know, their population is just going to have to decline. There's a demographic analyst named Peter Zion who is absolutely apocalyptic about what's happening in China. He says Chinese civilization is over by 2050. And that sounds a little extreme, but they are losing population at an accelerating rate.
And of course, with them having a bad economy and Taiwan being the world's biggest producer of computer chips, would they look at an invasion of Taiwan, or Taipei as they call it, as a way to solve that economic problem?
No. I mean, they might, from a nationalist standpoint, act to kind of to reintegrate this breakaway region that they don't like not being control of. I mean, they might do something like that, but it won't help them economically at all. Because probably to be able to take over Taiwan, they would have to risk blowing up those world-class microchip factories. And see, the U.S., we rely on those chips, and they're not made anywhere else. So if China were to take out the chip-making capacity of Taiwan, it would be very bad for them, but it would be devastating for us. And I think that's part of the reason why the U.S. acts like it's going to intervene in a Taiwan-China battle. Not so much that we care geopolitically whether Taiwan is run by China or not, but because those microchip plants are irreplaceable in the short run. And a big chunk of the American economy depends on those chips. That would be a very serious deal right now.
Well, doesn't a big part of the Chinese economy depend on a healthy U.S. economy?
Yes. Yeah. So we're all interconnected, and a crisis in one place risks turning into a crisis in other places. And it isn't clear that the U.S. government understands that. That's what's so scary about this, is they're doing things that that make it seem like they're not living in the same world as the rest of us, because we're living, you and Jim, you and I are living in an interconnected world where we depend on each other. And, you know, you can argue about whether that's a good thing or a bad thing in the long run, and maybe we need to bring all the factories back home, which, you know, that's arguably true. But in the short run, you pull any major player out of these global supply chains, and the supply chains break. And there are a lot of things that we just flat out can't replace without the operation of the supply chains that bring them to us. So we're in no condition to be taking China out of the equation, or Russia. You know, we basically need those guys for what they supply to the rest of the world. And we should, I think we should take that into account when we're dealing with them.
Sure. You know, the war in Ukraine has caused a shortage of sunflower oil, and Russia has all those restrictions now on their oil exports. And Russia without oil exports or natural gas, that's bad for their economy.
And Russia and Ukraine are very big parts of the global agricultural sector, and you know, including fertilizer. And Russia, obviously, is a big energy exporter. Yeah, you know, you take these guys out of the equation, and all of a sudden things get much harder. So let's bring them back into the equation.
The electric car market is imploding or going through growing pains. What happened, and what does it mean for the car makers and the price of copper?
Well, something shocking has happened in the electric car market in the last couple of years. Now, everybody assumed that electric cars were the future, and most big governments out there have been acting as if the case by subsidizing and passing a bunch of rules about how many gas-powered cars are going to be allowed on the road in 2050 and 2035 and things like that. And, you know, they were assuming that it was technically doable. But what's happened lately is that electric cars have turned out to have some big flaws, one of which is their batteries have to be replaced at a certain point, and it's insanely expensive. It's, you know, $20,000 or $30,000 or $40,000 in just, you know, something that's not covered by warranty or anything, just some big maintenance charge that might be more than you pay for the car. So, and you can't just check a battery pack and see when it's going to die. They don't have a test for that yet. So used electric cars are plunging in price. They have the worst resale value of anything short of, you know, Chrysler's. But the new car market for electric cars is also drying up. You're seeing Ford just basically shut down assembly lines for their pickup trucks and their Mustang. But anyhow, that's a big deal for the electric car market. It means they're not going to sell as many cars as they think. It's not going to be as easy to make the transition. And we may not need all the copper that we thought we were going to need, which is what affects the copper price. Because if we're electrifying more slowly, then the supply-demand imbalances won't be as outrageous as people think they will be. So that's a somewhat negative thing copper.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, well, for copper's price, that's all.
Right. And, I mean, an electric vehicle, I wrote the numbers down because they're incredible. An EV uses 277% more copper than a regular vehicle, 83 kilograms, 183 pounds. But the price of copper, it closed a year ago at $381. And at the start of the new year, 389. In other words, it's not moving anywhere. You'd think if EVs were the way to go, copper prices would be three times that by now.
Well, you know, sometimes things operate at a lag where there's stockpiles of something. You run through the stockpiles, and that's when the shortage really hits. So I think that's still coming for copper because we, you know, we are electrifying. And it could be that it's not that big of a difference between, you know, electrifying at a crazy rate and electrifying at a rapid rate. So if we just drop down to rapid, that still leads to a shortage of copper and higher prices. Maybe it just might not be as dramatic as it would have been otherwise. And it also impacts the, you know, the share price of a lot of the companies that are involved in the EV market. Tesla's stock just fell by, what was it, 14% yesterday or something? Some big number. And a big part of that is that they're having to cut their prices in order to move products, which means lower margins. And it's you know, that's hard for Tesla, but devastating for the other EV car makers. So it's a market in turmoil right now. And it's conceivable that there are going to be some really good used car opportunities at some point in the future.
U.S. interest rates are rising again. Did the Fed pause too soon? That's real interest rates, not those set by the central bank.
Well, long-term bond rates in the U.S. The 10-year Treasury yield, which is the kind of the benchmark rate, it got up to 5%, then it crashed down to 3.75% when everybody thought, you know, the Fed is done raising rates and they're going to start easing soon and they must be doing that because the economy is dropping into a recession. Well, a lot of the headline numbers have stayed pretty good. So a recession isn't here yet, we think. And the fact that the headline numbers are still pretty good means that the Fed is liable to delay its onset of easing. In other words, it won't start cutting interest rates further into the future than we thought. So that made interest rates go back up again. So it's kind of a, you know, a little bit of a catch-22 right now. If the Fed engineers a soft landing, interest rates won't drop and they might go back up, which would give us a hard landing further out. So, you know, when you borrow this much money, life is a mess regardless. So right now, it's more of a question of timing. When does everything fall apart than whether it falls apart? And interest rates are a big part of that story.
It's earnings season, and there have been some notable disappointments, including Tesla and Intel. What does this mean?
Well, Tesla, I mentioned already. Their earnings were good, but their guidance was bad. And so the stock tanked. Same thing with Intel. Intel crushed it in its most recent quarterly report, but its guidance for the year ahead was very disappointing, and its stock tanked too. I think that's part of a broader story where, last year was pretty good, but the near-term trends are pointing towards a tougher 2024. So that might be the source of the recession. You know, you get some disappointing earnings, which leads to layoffs, which leads to lower consumer spending, which leads to even more disappointing corporate earnings, and there you go. So this could be an early part of that process that we're watching.
Yeah, corporations hear, oh, recession's on the way, they lay off people, but that is the cause of the recession, isn't it? They overreact?
Well, markets do tend to overreact, but that's because we don't have perfect information. So when you do something like downsize your company, you're trying to get it right, but you don't know the exact number that you're going to need 2 years hence. And so you might, if you don't downsize enough, then your numbers are really bad and you're in trouble. If you over downsize, then you don't have the capacity to handle earning or handle orders going forward, and you got a problem there. But, you know, they're always trying to get it right. They just very seldom do because the future is inherently unknowable. We're likely to see that here. Could well be that a lot of companies lay off more people than they end up wishing that they had, but it's not because they're malicious or even that they're stupid. It's just because, they're operating with incomplete information in an unknowable world.
There were labor shortages, at least up until now. Are these people being laid off, being absorbed by others? If a high-tech large company lays off people, do smaller companies snap them up?
So far, yes. There's been a very tight labor market for a long time. So the fact that, you know, Citigroup lays off 20,000 people and Amazon lays off 10,000 people, those are pretty good numbers, but they can be absorbed. But let the economy slow down from here, the layoffs will get bigger, and then we'll reach a point where it isn't absorbed, and then the unemployment rate starts going up, and then you get all the typical recession things. You know, all the trends turn negative, all the numbers get bad, stocks tank, bankruptcy soar. You know, that's all coming. And you know, all I'm saying by predicting that is that we're still in a business cycle. We will build up imbalances that have to be worked off, and we have some hellacious imbalances right now. So I think the working off process is going to be one for the record books when it happens.
The U.S. is banning the granting of new export licenses for LNG. What does that tell the energy sector?
Well, it tells the energy sector that the people in charge don't have the faintest idea what they're doing from an energy independence standpoint. We in the U.S., we have massive reserves of natural gas. In fact, it's burned off in a lot of places where they're drilling for shale oil, for instance. They just vent a lot of natural gas and just let it flare off. So we could use that to make all kinds of petrochemical related products. And if we had if the guys in charge had any brains, they would be expanding the natural gas sector in the U.S. for exports and for use here, to keep our domestic prices super low and give our manufacturing companies big advantages because of cheap energy. They don't seem to get that so far, but with any luck, they'll come around.
Well, isn't liquefied natural gas a better alternative than coal? I mean, Germany, when Russian natural gas imports were cut off, they have resorted to firing up and building new coal plants. Isn't natural gas a better way to go? And when did natural gas become an evil thing?
That's a good point, because it's much cleaner than coal or oil. But it gets lumped. It's a fossil fuel, so it gets lumped together with all the other things, and the environmentalists hate it. But the U.S. has had a really good record of cutting its emissions in the last decade. And the reason for that is because we switched a lot of coal over to natural gas. So natural gas actually allowed us to meet our near-term emissions goals. It would work the same way in the rest of the world. But liquefied natural gas is expensive, because you take it out of the ground, you've got to compress it and put it in a vehicle that can handle compression, and then move it somewhere else and then do things with it there. And, so it's super expensive compared to the pipeline that used to run from Russia to Germany. But after the U.S. blew that up, Germany's in bad shape, because yes, they can get liquefied natural gas, but it costs so much that it prices a lot of their export products out of the market. So Germany is going through a thing that economists call deindustrialization, where they close all their factories and kind of regress as a society. They're going to be a lot richer, a lot poorer 10 years from now than they are today. And apparently there's no fix for that, because they lost their good pipeline, and they can, they can burn coal and cut down forests and burn the wood, or they can import incredibly expensive liquid natural gas. That doesn't save them. So I'm not sure what the solution is for Germany at all.
Well, we know what happened last time their economy really got into trouble, about 90 years ago.
Yeah, you would think that we would be really sensitive to German discontent, right? Because of what they do when they're not happy. So, again, the cluelessness of the people making decisions today is just shocking. I don't know what the solution is.
Well, our federal government too didn't talk about exporting natural gas to Germany. It'll be hydrogen. Well, nobody's using hydrogen. It's hard to transport, and people still have images of the Hindenburg in their, the one image from the 30s they still have.
Hydrogen has a really bright future.
Yeah.
Because that might solve some of the problems. If we use hydrogen fuel cells to run cars, then you don't have the problem of the battery costing you $40,000 to replace. So it's completely possible that fuel cells are the electric car solution of the future. But to get that hydrogen, that's energy intensive. So if we get it by burning coal, we don't save anything on the emissions side. But if we get it with nuclear power, then we have the potential from an emissions standpoint to go green. And nuclear plants, they basically run 24/7. So, you know, you power your city with a nuke plant in the daytime, and then you make hydrogen at night, and then put it in the cars. And, you know, so there's a very interesting energy future with hydrogen and nuclear together. So we'll see. But that's a ways away. I mean, that's a 20-year out thing, even if we start trying to make it happen now, because there just aren't enough nuclear plants to make that a reality. But it's something that could happen in the future. And I think, you know, the way life works is you make a mistake, you take a wrong turn, you go back and forth, and you end up where you need to be, but it took twice as long and cost five times as much. Well, that's probably where we're going to go with energy. We'll eventually be a nuclear/hydrogen society with a lot of solar on the side, but it's going to take a while.
Now, I also saw an article about helium reactors, because helium doesn't become radioactive. You could have a telephone-sized booth in your neighborhood powering that whole suburb using a helium reactor. But is that just an experimental thing?
I'm totally unfamiliar with that, so I have no idea. But, you know, I like new ideas, though, so hopefully that's something that that is viable.
Gold's still holding above above $2,000 an ounce. Is this the new support level?
Wouldn't that be nice? You know, and so far so good, because gold recently bounced off of 2,000, which means that level was acting like support. But we're, you know, we're a long ways away from being able to call it and say, yes, 2,000 is now support. It has to bounce off of it a few more times. Or go up into the 2,100-2,200 range, so the 2,000 is just way back in the rearview mirror. And if that happens, it will eventually happen. If it happens this time around, though, that's really good for the miners, because a lot of projections for gold miner earnings and cash flow are based on $1,800-1,900 gold. So let it be $200 or $300 more than that, and all of a sudden, cash flow is going to be a pleasant surprise for the gold miners going forward, and that'll help their share prices. So, you know, here's hoping 2,000 stays as support, and that will make the next few earnings cycles really positive for the big miners.
What do you expect for the gold and silver miners this earnings season?
I think it'll be okay. You know, mining is still a tough business. They have high expenses in a lot of cases, with labor being super tight and energy, you know, in the recent past, energy was very expensive. So, you know, the numbers might not be spectacular. But to the extent that they're selling $2,000 gold, whereas a year ago they were selling $1,800 or $1,900 gold, they might have a little bit of margin expansion, which will help them. So I think I'm cautiously optimistic about gold and silver mining earnings this time around. And we're going to find out soon. A lot of them are going to come out in the next couple of weeks. But I think they'll be mostly okay, and in a couple of cases, pretty good. And that might be enough of a relief for the markets to help their stock prices.
Is oil going to crawl out of the low to mid-70s?
Well, if the economy slows down in 2024, oil is very cyclical. So we could see, 40s and 50s at some point in the bottom part of this cycle. And there's another interesting thing happening with oil. Doomberg, an energy analyst who has a big presence online and on Substack, just came out with a new analysis of the petroleum market. And they said that we have so much natural gas now, it's just not funny. And people are building new refineries that can take natural gas and turn them into things that we used to get from oil. So we need to start counting natural gas as part of our oil supply and production, which means we're making a lot more oil than we thought, and we have a lot more oil in the future pipeline than we thought we did before. So maybe peak oil is decades away or forever away. You know, we may never hit peak oil, which that changes the dynamic of the oil market pretty dramatically. It kind of gives a tailwind to new uses for petroleum and headwind to the price of oil. So we'll see. But there are reasons to expect oil to have kind of a weak 2024, put it that way. No guarantees. And geopolitical turmoil could give us $200 a barrel oil again in a heartbeat. But barring, you know, us going to war with Russia or something like that, or Iran, oil probably stays where it is or trends down a little bit this year.
Well, before the EV craze, there was a big push to get people to use natural gas to power their cars. I remember testing out a natural gas-powered police car and actually beat the high-speed instructor going through an obstacle course with it. Perhaps just luck on my side, or he was unlucky. But all of a sudden, that went away. Recently has natural gas become an evil product, so-called.
Yeah, it's unfortunate because it's really a good transition fuel. If we're concerned about CO2 emissions, natural gas is an excellent way to lower them in the coming decade while other technologies come along. So I don't know. It's possible that people come around to that too because, you know, wind and solar have not done as well as people expected them to. So we need alternatives because they are clearly not going to dominate the energy market in the near term. And that's why nuclear is coming back so strong. And I think natural gas should be part of that new energy mix going forward. And, you know, it's possible that you can run fuel cells on natural gas too. So it might be that natural gas is a competitor of hydrogen in the fuel cell market at some point. So we'll see. But clearly, we don't have it right yet. You know, we got to figure out a better strategy than we've employed in the previous decade.
Yes, and Ballard Power here in Vancouver, fuel cells. Again, they don't pollute, and they're trying to get people to use them. And yet, you know, authorities probably aren't aware of it because they don't have billions of dollars to push their message.
Well, and the technology is not really there yet cost-wise.
Yeah.
Hydrogen is expensive to make, and if you're paying a lot of money to make it by burning coal, you don't really gain anything, you know. And like you said, hydrogen is dangerous. So we have to make 100% sure that we deal with that danger, you know, so the car just doesn't explode when it gets into a fender bender or something like that. So, you know, all that has to happen. But it's, you know, those are engineering challenges, not physics challenge. We don't have to define some new law of nature for this to work. We just have to figure out how to make a tank that won't rupture and explode. And we have to generate electricity in ways that don't emit CO2, you know, and those are all completely doable. It's a public policy thing that can get us there. And it's just, it's going to take a while, but as long as we're heading in the right direction, that's the best we can hope for.
John, what's the best way to follow you?
I'm at rubino.substack.com, and my Substack newsletter there covers a lot of the stuff we just talked about, along with a lot of more specific investing-related issues.
John, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thanks, Jim.
My guest has been John Rubino, author of several books on the economy, including The Money Bubble. He founded the website dollarcollapse.com. Find him on Substack at rubino.substack.com. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Alan Mark Angel, and John Rubino. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.